This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear about a 55% cut in an auto insurance fee, plus a look at the state's proposed restrictions on PFAS in drinking water.
Well, I think they're an important step in the right direction.
Then we hear about a Detroit ordinance to improve rental homes that's not working.
Meanwhile, there's people who are living in those substandard conditions and paying money to live in those substandard conditions.
We learn about a program to make farms more environmentally friendly.
We're not here to take tools away. We're here to make sure that the tools are being used appropriately.
And the debate in the legislature about baiting deer.
It's no longer about science. It's now about Republican science and Democratic science.
Plus egg, lemon, chili pepper, and beets. Just part of a cocktail from Cheers to Michigan. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. More than half of the people living in Detroit rent, yet the city has struggled to hold landlords accountable for safety and the condition of their properties. Later in the program, we'll look at what more Detroit can do to protect renters. But first, this week, the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, MCCA for short, announced next year's fee for unlimited lifetime personal injury protection drops from $220 per year per vehicle to $100 a year. That's a 55% drop in cost. The insurance industry immediately issued a news release showing that this is proof that changes in the new law will save people money. Wayne Miller is with the law firm Miller & Tischler, which specializes in cases involving catastrophic injury, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lester.
Okay, so the MCCA indicates the drop in the annual fee is due to cost controls for medical treatment. Why was that so significant that the MCCA could cut the fee to less than half of the current charge?
Well, it's interesting also, and I'm reading from the same line in their press release, the cost controls don't actually go into effect until July 1st, 2021. In other words, they're reducing the assessment effective the year before the cost controls go into effect. But apparently they feel that the anticipation of those cost controls allow them to make actuarial assessments that will allow them to reduce the charges per vehicle.
So right, because they're looking at the risk factors decades in advance.
Yes.
Now, of course, auto owners will also have the option of not paying the fee at all starting in July. They can choose a level of personal injury protection they want for the first time in 40 years, including no injury protection at all. What do you think of those changes to the law?
Well, let's first be careful. The ability to opt out entirely is not for everyone. You have to be either a Medicare recipient or you have to have a qualified health plan. So for those people, yes, they will be able to opt out entirely and pay zero for the no-fault insurance portion of their auto insurance. For my part, though, since I've lived in the system and represented victims of catastrophic injury for 40 years now, I'm very concerned about that, and I think that's a false choice and a scary choice. People should buy the unlimited coverage because that's what insurance exists for, to protect people against the worst losses. People that do not select that, some of them will be fine. Most of them will be fine. They'll certainly save money, but God forbid, if the catastrophic loss should be visited upon them, they will not have available to them the wonderful benefits no-fault insurance allows for.
So let's talk about those benefits, because I'm wondering if these changes, will they put unlimited lifetime medical benefits at risk for people who want the coverage?
Yeah, one of the important changes that's being made is fee schedules. And the fee schedules are rather draconian, and particularly for those providers of long-term custodial care and rehabilitation. The fee schedule for those facilities, residential rehabilitation facilities, currently under the new law that will go into effect July 2021, is 55%. In other words, there's going to be a 45% cut for those facilities. And it is widely understood now that they will not be able to stay in business. Nobody operates with a 45% margin, no matter how the insurance industry feels about the way service providers charge. No one has that kind of a margin. So they're going to go out of business, and even if you have the catastrophic coverage, you will not have the facilities available that will be able to provide care at that level.
Okay, let's sum this up then. Who are the winners? Who are the losers in these changes?
The winners, I believe, are the insurance industry. And actually, we haven't had a chance to talk much about the tort changes in the law, but the tort changes will be very good for some of the trial lawyers, which is a weird result of an insurance law like this. The reason for that is that even though no fault will allow reductions in benefit choices, you will be required to buy more in liability coverages. So the $20,000 mandatory minimum that we've had for 50 years now goes up to $250,000 effective next July, although you will have the ability to opt down to $50,000. But the result is you have a choice to reduce your PIP coverages, but you'll be required to increase your liability coverages. So as a result of that, I think some of the plaintiff tort lawyers will benefit from this, and have serious doubts that the general public is going to receive much in the way of premium savings as a result.
Wayne Miller is an attorney and the chair of the law firm Miller & Tischler, which specializes in cases involving catastrophic injury. Thanks for the time. The state of Michigan is a step closer to establishing limits on the levels of PFAS allowed in drinking water. PFAS is a family of chemicals being found in high levels in some Michigan drinking water sources, and there's no regulation at the federal level. Joining us to talk about that is Tony Spagnola. He's a lawyer, and he owns lake property in Oscoda. The Van Atten Lake near the former Wordsmith Air Force Base was contaminated by PFAS and firefighting foam. The base was the site of training programs on using firefighting foam. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, Lester. Great to be here.
So let's talk about the levels the state is recommending. The maximum level is different for three chemicals in the PFAS family, the most common PFAS contaminants, we should say. What do you think of the regulations as proposed?
Well, I think they're an important step in the right direction. I think that it's very, very critical that we take action as quickly as we can to get regulations in place, enforceable regulations and workable regulations to limit and bring down the exposure levels to these chemicals in our water systems.
So as I mentioned, there are no federal regulations. There's some guidance, but no regulations on this. How do these drinking water limits compare to other states that have implemented limits on PFAS?
Well, they tend to be on the lower side, similar to some limits that have been set in, just went into effect at the end of September in New Hampshire. So they are much more protective than the guidance that was set by the EPA. Right now we're seeing the state of New Jersey, the state of Vermont, the state of New Hampshire are a little bit ahead of us in this process. And have each taken, you know, slightly different approaches, but the numbers, particularly for the most commonly studied of these chemicals, PFOA and PFOS, that's PFOA is in the old Teflon, and PFOS was formerly used in Scotchgard. The numbers in Michigan are very similar to the numbers that are coming down in those leading states.
So some people are going to say, any PFAS in water is too much, that regulations should be zero. Is that even practical?
Well, the some people who say that there shouldn't be any PFAS in water would include me. These chemicals were not manufactured for human consumption. However, they're there, and in order to have an enforceable regulation, we have to make sure that we can measure accurately the PFAS in our water systems, and when we're talking parts per trillion, that's the scientists will tell you that's a very low level of measurement. And so my understanding is that with accuracy we can get down to about 5 parts per trillion. So and some of these the PFNA, the PFOA are pretty close to that, I think that we will see, and in fact, the governor's scientific advisory panel indicated in their report that that is the basis for these levels, that the trend in the science over time is lower. So I would like, you know, in the perfect world, I would love to see no PFAS in any water. From a practical standpoint, and as a lawyer, I know that we have to do, you know, what's enforceable. So these are an important step in the right direction. I think that over time, as our ability to measure these chemicals improves, and as the scientific basis for this improves, I think we'll see the numbers go lower.
I want to talk about your personal situation. As far as I can tell, this is not going to help you. The lake will still be contaminated. How are you getting water at your house on Van Etten Lake now?
At my house on Van Etten Lake, we have been provided with a single source reverse osmosis filter system for the kitchen sink. That's how we get our drinking water. And it's only one tap, which, if you can imagine, having to go through the day and think consciously about only drinking from one tap or brushing your teeth or whatever, it's a bit of a challenge. In Oscoda, our township is doing its very best to try to extend municipal water lines to homes, including mine.
When I last talked to the township officials, they were, you know, a little frustrated because they weren't getting the kind of money they needed from the state. Will the Air Force or some other entity be paying to extend those Oscoda water mains?
The Air Force will not. The Air Force has been very, very difficult to deal with. What the township is doing right now is patching together, with the help of our congressional folks in Washington, D.C., the USDA will provide grants of $1 million per year to do these kinds of extensions. So they're patching together, they're doing this in phases, $1 million phases, and looks like it's probably going to take about 10 years in order to get it all done. So the federal government is helping in that sense. The Air Force, though, I can't say enough about how terribly the Air Force has treated our community and communities like us around the country. It's really, really disgusting. They are simply trying to reduce their liability. They don't have any real significant sense or concern for human health. And even with the state trying, we have a state surface water regulation that they're violating on my lake. And if they complied with that, it would clean my lake up, and they're refusing to do that. So we really need to continue to pressure the Air Force and the Department of Defense to take a different posture.
Tony Spaniola is a lawyer and a member of the group Now Need Our Water in Oscoda. We've been talking about the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy proposed restrictions on PFAS in drinking water. Coming up, we'll hear about a program that works with Michigan farmers to find cost-effective solutions to erosion, runoff, and other environmental effects from farming. That's next here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's growing concern about pollution from farms, whether it's nitrogen pollution in Lake Erie, livestock waste polluting creeks, pesticides, greenhouse gases released during plowing. Farmers are realizing there are some things that need to happen. My next guests are helping farmers work on some of those issues. Josh Appleby is a verifier for the Michigan Agriculture Environmental Assurance Program, commonly called MEAP. He does that in several counties in western Michigan, and he was part of MEAP's pilot program. Mike Ludlum is a livestock farmer, and he's become a MEAP technician. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So when and why did the Michigan Agriculture Environmental Assurance Program start, Josh?
Well, it really started back in the late 1990s when a very smart group of farmers, commodity organizations, state agencies, a really broad partnership, conservation groups got together and said, we see a need to assist the agricultural industry in Michigan move forward with environmental issues. We see a need for a program that brings this broad group of people together and helps farmers know what the expectations are. There was not a lot of agreement on what expectations were or best ways to get there. And over the course of time, working together with now over 70 partners in this program, we've developed a certification, verification process that works with farmers voluntarily, one-on-one, on their farms to address their environmental liabilities and give them recognition for the great work that they're doing.
You're a verifier for MEEP compliance. What are you looking for during a visit?
So I'm the last stop before they earn that verification status. I am out doing a third-party audit. They've worked with our technicians, other agencies, other partners in the pursuit of meeting the MEEP requirements. And I do that final check. So I'm looking for anything that could have been missed and confirming that they meet all the requirements.
So, Mike, you're a technician for MEEP. So what do you do to help the farmer get ready?
So I meet with the farmer on their farm, and we go through what we call a tool. It's a checklist of questions on the farm. The farmer and I sit down, and we walk around the farm and go through and just kind of decide between us what is the risk of that particular question. At the end of it, if we find anything that needs to be improved on, it's my job then to go back and make a list, a to-do list, if you would, and give it back to the farmer. And then it's all on their schedule as they want to proceed with it. Once they get the checklist completed, they get back with me. Usually they get back with me a few times in between. We go through and do kind of a final run through to make sure that I didn't miss anything the first time. Then at that point, they call in and make an appointment with the verifier. And then the verifier comes out and makes sure that I didn't miss anything.
You know, I grew up on a farm, and I know farmers don't like to be told what to do. How do you approach them when you have suggestions?
Oftentimes, we see an issue. Let's say, for example, erosion on a field. And we may have a suite of opportunities to address that. It could be cover crops or no-till or minimum tillage. But the reality is the solution lies with the producer and their creativity. They've been farming that ground for many years. They know what happens when there's a big rainfall. They know where the water goes to and how it moves across the field. They understand what equipment they have access to and what works in their farming system with the crops they're growing and their rotations. And so we really leave it up to them, and they ultimately always come up with the best solution and how to address that. Now, we fact check it to make sure that solution will work, but the reality is if and when they come up with that solution and it's one that works for their farm, we're very confident that we'll continue to do that when we're not there to watch it.
So, Mike, why'd you get involved in this?
Well, I'm a sheep farmer, and I sell wool, and I thought it would be a good idea for marketing at the initial when I got involved with MEEP. And once the technician came out to work with me, I realized there was a lot more to it. And I had a few things on my farm that I needed to correct, and I thought I was doing everything the right way. There was a couple things that, you know, once he pointed it out, I was like, oh, yeah, that's a no-brainer. I understand now.
We are not going to go down the whole list, but what are some of the major things a farm has to do to be MEEP verified?
So I think one of the most common ones that people are interested in hearing about because of nutrients are solid nutrient management plans. All of the things that we do to produce a vibrant, healthy crop, but at the same time not using extra things that could end up in the environment.
Do you limit what kind of, I don't know, chemicals they use, or require only no-till, or put other restrictions like that to attain a MEEP verification?
No, we don't. You know, it's really interesting to think it would be lovely if there was one thing that would fix everything that could ever happen on a farm. The reality is there are so many different farming systems, so many different commodities. We're second only to California. And so many different soil types and climate issues that really we have to look specifically at each farm. And so where no-till may be a good practice on one farm, it doesn't work on another. We don't limit chemicals. What we look at is to make sure they're following the labels. Those chemistries are heavily studied and registered for use. And we're not here to take tools away. We're here to make sure that the tools are being used appropriately.
Well, we talked to another farmer, too, a guy named John Cox. And he doesn't think MEEP goes far enough.
The MEEP program is kind of a joke. It's funded by industry, and you don't really have to do anything special other than not be a bad polluter.
And John Cox says beyond MEEP, consumers should take more of an active role in making sure that their food is coming from a farm with sound environmental practices.
Farming is responsible for a lot of pollution, and I think for people to start to first of all recognize that, and second, think about what that can be done about it. So I just like to see the consumer, instead of just buying the cheapest food they can find, try to think about it a little more and just look at what the, you know, what the ramifications of one purchase or another is.
Again, John Cox is a farmer. What do you think of his opinion of MEEP?
Well, everybody's certainly entitled to their opinion, and I hope he's had an opportunity to review all of our standards. We feel it's quite rigorous. It's not easy to achieve MEEP verification. Some farms are already there. Maybe his farm was one of those where he didn't feel he needed to make many changes. But
he's MEEP verified.
Well, good. So we're always happy to do more. Our standards are available for everybody to see and make their own conclusions, I guess, as to whether or not they go far enough at our website. You know, working with this broad partnership, we don't always agree on every standard. But the strength of the program is that we're all working together towards the same goal. Our standards are updated and changed annually with public input and partner input. So we would certainly welcome his suggestions if he has specific concerns with the standards.
So every year it gets a little more rigorous?
It can. There's every year we learn more, too. Agriculture as well as any industry, as well as our daily lives as people have an impact, and as science changes and understanding changes, so do our standards. We try to stay current. We try to work with things that, as a broad group, we believe work and are achievable and are economically viable for farms to do. You know, laws change, standards change, recommendations change. Frankly, the industry changes faster than any of that. With precision agriculture and a lot of the tools that are coming out of industry that have a lot of economic benefit also have quite a lot of environmental benefit as well. It's like getting better gas mileage in your car. You're saving money and you're helping protect the environment, and farming is no different. If they can use less inputs and have healthier soil and save money and protect the environment, it's a win-win.
There's something like 47,000 farms in Michigan, I'm told. How many are participating in the MEEP program?
We have about 5,300 and some verifications.
That's higher than I expected. I do see the signs around a bit, but I didn't think it'd be that many.
Yeah. Well, and not everybody puts them up. Some people just want to know they're doing the right things, and they don't want to brag, so to speak.
I'd say 40% don't put the sign up.
Huh.
Our goal is more to have an impact on the farm and to have an impact on the community and the watershed that they're in. We do have number of farm verification goals because that's something we can count, but it may not be the best measurement really for the impact the program is having.
Mike, coming from one aspect of agriculture and having to visit farms that might be, I don't know, orchards or beet farms or, you know, row crops, how do you get prepared for that to be able to make sure that you can help them meet these MEEP requirements?
Actually, that's probably the funnest part of my job is I live in Allegan County, and we're very diverse in agriculture. We have everything from blueberries, dairies, Christmas trees, nurseries, greenhouses, you name it, we have it. And everybody's slightly different. And it takes a while, I'll be honest, to get trained up to where you feel comfortable when you get onto a different commodity group. But at that same time, I'm also learning from the farmer. And I ask them as many questions as they ask me so that I can learn more to help the next guy down the road.
Okay, I want both of you to take a big step back and look big picture. How important is MEEP to the future of agriculture in Michigan.
Who else, if you have issues that can holistically look at your farm for you and voluntarily and confidentially on your timeline help you address those issues? We have built a tremendous trust in the agricultural community, a warranted trust. We've been doing this almost 20 years now, in helping farmers fix issues. And they can be very complex at times. Without a program like MEAT, I think we're back to getting four or five or six or seven different answers from four or five or six different agencies in how you should address issues. If you're being told by the fire marshal your fuel tank needs to be in one place and Eagle something else for environmental reasons and Department of Ag something else for efficiency, what's a farmer to do when they make that kind of an investment and find out a year later that somebody else doesn't like how they've done that? We're really here to facilitate their success. We're here to protect our agricultural heritage, protect our environment. We have to remember these folks live where they work, and they want to do the best things.
So, Mike, you get the last word.
I think as a technician, you know, I've been doing this almost 7 years now, and I can't believe it's gone so fast. I enjoy the work. I enjoy troubleshooting and helping farmers come up with something that fixes on their farms that work for them. Because if I just tell them they got to do this, that doesn't get anywhere. If I work with them and say, will this work for you? And they say, yeah, I can deal with that. That's going to work fine. I know it's going to, you know, they're going to continue to do that practice, whatever it may be. If I get one farm to change one practice, I'm still, even if they never get verified, I'm still way ahead. In my personal view, I fixed a little bit.
Mike Ludlam is a livestock farmer, and he's become a Michigan Agriculture Environmental Assurance Program technician. Josh Appleby is a verifier for the Michigan Agriculture Environmental Assurance Program in several counties in western Michigan, and he was part of the MEAPS pilot program. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
The folks here at Stateside, we want to hear from you. What do you think are the most important stories we should be checking out? What issues do you want to hear covered? Tell us. Our email is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, @StatesideRadio. And at MichiganRadio.org, just click the link that says Stateside.
Cheers.
Cheers.
You're using that muddler like a weapon.
I had some frustrations to work out, Lester.
It's Tammy Cox, and with Tammy Stasings, I'm Lester Graham, and we're here for another episode of Cheers to Michigan. What is in there that you're smashing up?
Well, Lester, how do you feel about beets?
You know how I feel about beets. I hate beets.
Oh, I think I'm going to change your mind with this drink.
Good luck. I keep trying beets every couple of years. I finally gotten to the point where I'm kind of like George H.W. Bush. He stopped eating his broccoli. I'm not going to eat beets anymore. I've only had one other drink with beets in it, and that was for an episode we did with Valentine Distillery, and that was actually pretty good.
Well, so maybe all you need to make beets palatable, Lester, is a little bit of gin, because that's what I'm using here today as well.
Okay, great. What's this called?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I just came up with it. So I'm using Knickerbocker Gin, and it's got beets in it, so I'm going to call it Knicker Beet.
That's descriptive. This is really actually very beautiful. It's got a beautiful color. And then you've got so much foam on the top of this. I assume there's some egg involved in it.
Yep, it's got an egg white in it. And I did the double shake technique where you first shake it without any ice and then you shake it with ice. And then this also has some club soda. So that's going to enhance that foam even more.
Oh, nice. Well, it's very pretty. How do you make this thing besides two shakes and beets?
I started off with a slice of beets from an average size beet, and I chop them up small, and then I beat the heck out of them with my muddler.
Okay, go ahead.
And then I added 1.5 ounces of Knickerbocker gin, 1 ounce of pomegranate juice, that's contributing some of the color along with the beets, 1 ounce of simple syrup, 0.75 ounces of lemon juice, and 1 egg white. Oh, and then 2 dashes of these mutters. So these are bitters that a friend of mine is experimenting with that he makes with the random chili peppers that he grows in his yard. And he gave them to me to play with, and I thought they were just the thing that this cocktail needed to take it to the next level.
Well, that sounds interesting. Should I taste it now?
Sure.
Okay. foam's almost impossible to get around. I almost need a straw or something, it seems like. Okay. The beet taste that I really don't like, I don't find it in this drink. I do find a lot of lovely layers, I have to say, and the foam, you know, I'm not crazy about egg foam. This is different than that, though. It just seems to have a little different taste and different texture.
It's magic, Lester. It's just magic.
And a little bit of club soda, I guess.
That would also be the trick. So I can definitely tell there are beets there, but it's in this sort of subtle earthiness that it adds to the cocktail rather than any overt beet flavor.
So I know we have Michigan sugar beets. Is that what we're talking about here?
Oh, no, no. You would never want to eat sugar beets. So these are just red beets, regular beets that you get at the farmer's market this time of year. Sugar beets are a whole different variety. They go through a whole different process to turn them into sugar. You couldn't turn these into sugar, but you can eat them. See? You can totally eat them.
I don't mind drinking them. I'm not sure I'm sold on eating them yet.
Cheers.
Cheers. Still to come, we'll look at what more Detroit can do to protect renters as the city struggles to hold landlords accountable for safety and the condition of their properties.
If a renter is trying to participate in this ordinance and hold back their rent, that they can't be evicted for not paying their rent, because that's the whole point of the ordinance, is to allow them to hold back their rent in hopes of forcing a landlord to make repairs.
That's after the break.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. More than half the people in Detroit rent their homes. And back in 2017, the city set a 2-year timeline to bring all rental properties into compliance with new rules. That's not gone so well. Joining me now is Sarah Alvarez, the director of Outlier Media, who wrote about it in Curb Detroit. She's also worked here at Michigan Radio as a reporter. Hey, it's good to talk to you again.
It's good to talk to you.
So let's start with those 2017 requirements for rental homes for landlords. What did the city of Detroit want?
So basically what they wanted, what the department that's in charge of enforcing this rental property ordinance said they wanted, was to kind of ensure the same conditions across the city so that a renter who's renting in a stable neighborhood isn't necessarily going to get their house will be different, but the baseline would be the same across the city in more stable neighborhoods and in neighborhoods that have had a rougher time of it.
So basically, everything works. You've got a furnace that's in good shape, things like that.
Yeah, and I think what they really want, so, I mean, important context is that so much of the housing stock in Detroit is old, right? Most of the houses in Detroit are 50 years old or more. So that means like repairs can be very costly for landlords, but also really necessary for renters. And so I think what the city was interested in doing and what they said they were interested in doing was making sure that some of those basics that can really fall apart in an older home were available for all renters. Like you said, heating, windows. A big one is the presence of lead paint, those kind of basics that are really important for health and safety.
So not only are some of these homes old, but, you know, many of those were vacant or foreclosed upon, and investors picked them up and tried to put them back in the market. So how has that impacted the whole goal of getting rental properties in good shape across the city?
Right. The goal of getting rental properties in good shape, that's what the city wants to see. I think what you saw a lot of investors doing was hoping to make money off of rental properties. And that doesn't necessarily, that goal of having a rental property be in good shape, doesn't necessarily align with the goal of making money off of it. So, of course, there are a lot of smaller landlords who are really trying to get a property back into productive use, renovate it so they can rent it out for a good rent and make money on that in the short or the long term. But there are a lot of other landlords that you saw buying properties in, and they're mostly investors, not even really landlords, buying properties, trying to rent them out without really doing repairs, and then returning them to the tax auction in 3 years. So that, I think, is who the rental inspection ordinance was really aimed at. And that's the behavior that it was kind of supposed to curb, was people buying properties up cheap and trying to milk as much money out of them. And meanwhile, there's people who are living in those substandard conditions and paying money to live in those substandard conditions.
For any ordinance to actually be effective, you have to have enforcement. And you write that the 36th District Court refused to fully enforce the new ordinance. What was that all about?
I think that was kind of one of the main downfalls of this ordinance in its early days, were that, you know, a landlord would go into court and say, this person is not paying rent, I want to evict them. And the tenant could say, I'm holding back my rent because they haven't made repairs and the city even told them to make repairs. And 36th District Court would say, well, that's not really, that's between you and the city. You haven't paid your rent. And if you don't pay your rent, you're going to be evicted. And that like cut the feet out from under this ordinance. And then Lakeshore Legal, which is a nonprofit legal group in Detroit, did kind of move that up through the courts. And the Third Circuit Court made it clear that the Detroit City Courts have to enforce it. If a renter is trying to participate in this ordinance and hold back their rent, that they can't be evicted for not paying their rent, because that's the whole point of the ordinance, is to allow them to hold back their rent in hopes of forcing a landlord to make repairs.
So the effectiveness of this 2017 ordinance has not been great, and there are problems. So why not just scrap that law, start over, and make it right?
Well, that's interesting. I think that the city, to its credit, understood that the goals of this ordinance were not being met and that it wasn't really working for renters. It wasn't increasing the safety of these dwellings, but it also really wasn't working for landlords. And that was not their intention, right? To make it difficult to be a good landlord. That's not what the city was trying to do. So they got a grant from the Kresge Foundation to really try to figure out what some of the unintended consequences of the rental ordinance were, and then try to solve for that. So they are not scrapping the ordinance. They are going to introduce some policy changes. And I think, to be honest, I think that one thing that was surprising to the city was the sheer number of rental properties. Like, Detroit used to be a place where most people owned their homes, and now it is a place where most people rent.
It was famous in the nation for having the most black family owned homes rate in the nation. So that's certainly changed. So how's that process going of hearing out tenants, hearing out landlords, looking at some of the unintended consequences? Are we in the middle of that? Are we nearing the end of that? Where is it?
Yeah, it's almost done. There's a few more meetings in December. But also, I would say that even if people can't make it to a meeting, but they care about this issue and they want their voice heard, that they should call the city directly. I do think that the city does honestly want to hear from people and know how they can be helpful, both for landlords and for renters. Like, one thing that landlords really complained about are the lead inspection rules, which are very expensive and for property owners need to happen very often. So that's, for example, that's one thing that the city kind of knows they need to address. But of course, they want to do it in a way that keeps renters safe. It's not an easy problem. You know, this is housing in Detroit is a really complicated thing. And it's a very hard problem to start to fix.
What will you be watching for next?
In terms of the rental registration program, I think what we will be watching for is how the courts continue to deal with this, like, so where the rubber really hits the road, if, you know, we want to look at evictions. And then we'll also be looking at which parts of the city are most able to come into compliance. And I think the city is more concerned about whether or not smaller landlords are able to weather this change, right? They want to encourage responsible rentals. And that means that, like, they're going to need to have a policy that works for these small landlords, and then also for people who own, you know, hundreds of properties. So I think we'll be watching to see how both of those groups, the big landlords and the small landlords, are able to navigate this, and ultimately what that means for regular Detroiters who rent.
Sarah Alvarez wrote the report, Detroit to Make Changes in Its Rental Registry Ordinance Due to Limited Compliance, for Curbed Detroit. She is the director of Outlier Media. Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much.
It's deer hunting season. A majority of legislators say they want to ignore the state's biologists who want to stop a practice that could spread a disease that's killing deer. Joining me to talk about that are our Friday political commentators. T.J. Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's also a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan Senate. So this practice has been around for a long time. Hunters put out food to lure deer to an area where they plan to hunt. It might range from scattering some apples or sugar beets to piles of corn or other feed. It's called baiting. And the biologists at the Department of Natural Resources say luring deer to be nose-to-nose eating feed could spread chronic wasting disease, which has killed deer in at least 9 counties, and they want to ban baiting. TJ, this week, legislators voted to approve legislation that would allow baiting, with some limits, to continue. What do you think of that?
Well, I think they're absolutely ignoring the science that goes along with practices of baiting. As you indicated, you know, deer grazing nose to nose, you know, being in close proximity is the best way to spread disease. And, you know, I think if you look at chronic wasting disease and that it's already have a zone that, you know, it's impossible to control, if we don't do something quickly to get on top of it, chronic wasting disease could spread in Michigan across the entire herd. And that would really hurt, I think, the industry of deer hunting generally if the herd were mostly infected with chronic wasting disease.
Ken, when the state hires scientists to help manage wildlife populations and those scientists say, hey, don't do that because it could spread a fatal disease, why would legislators ignore that advice?
Well, I have a little different take on this, at least in terms of process. I think elected officials, meaning the legislature and the governor here, should always have the final authority. That doesn't mean they should always exercise it or use it, but, you know, they're the ones who are directly accountable. And I don't think it's always a matter of ignoring the science. I think good science should certainly inform the ultimate decision, but you know, it's not just a scientific issue. It's also a cultural, social, and economic issue. And those, I guess, factors have to be weighed in as well. Now, that doesn't mean I think it's a good idea to overturn this baiting ban. But I do think, you know, we have to sort of have the right perspective about good science. It should help inform the decision, but in and of itself shouldn't be making the decision.
Well, the Gongwer News Service reports that Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky says he doubted the science that was used to determine baiting might spread chronic wasting disease, and that reversal of the ban is overdue. His logic is backed by the point, how many of you would go fishing and not put a worm on your hook? Which is not exactly the scenario we're talking about here. TJ, it seems some legislators doubt the science whenever it runs counter to what they want. What's the fallout of a policy approach like that?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, and listen, in 1996, right, voters decided on Proposal G. Okay, that in effect created a commission comprised of experts in charge of wildlife management decisions. So politics didn't trump the science. What was best for Michigan. That commission is still in place today. And we know that the ban on baiting has been successful. And we look at bovine tuberculosis, another disease that, you know, can be very impactful, you know, because we banned baiting, this disease, the prevalence in the TB zone has been reduced by 2/3. We know that the science works. You know, something tells me that there's politics at play here. You know, most of the wildlife associations, you know, who look at these kinds of things were opposed to lifting the ban. And I think you'll definitely see the governor veto it. But the bottom line for me is that, you know, we have a bigger picture here to to concern ourselves with, which is if we allow chronic wasting disease or other diseases to overtake Michigan's herd, our legacy of hunting in this state will probably come to a swift end. We're already seeing, the decrease in legacy hunters. I think licenses are down something like 40% this year. And we have to reverse that trend if we expect this to continue.
Ken, I want to go back to your point that science is just one factor here, that culture and many other things play into this. When you're talking about a resource like the deer herd of Michigan, and something might be endangering the resource, like the deer population of Michigan, shouldn't that trump any other concerns?
Well, generally speaking, and it depends on the quality of the science and the research, and apparently there's the research that's been done on this issue is pretty good, in that the Department of Natural Resources relied on many studies. But so generally speaking, I think you defer to good science, but it's not the only factor to consider. I'm not particularly justifying the decision made by the legislature, but I am supporting kind of the process that ultimately they have the ultimate decision, with the participation of the governor, who, as TJ pointed out, is probably going to veto this. So we're going to go back to the baiting ban.
Okay, you guys have been in Lansing a lot longer than I have, and I want to get in. In fact, I haven't been there for a while. I'm kind of on the outside looking in. So let me ask you about the history of this, because we've seen this trend in Washington and more recently in Lansing of how some members of Congress or the legislature say, we're skeptical about this science. We only want sound science, and sound science often is defined, like I said earlier, what they prefer. Is there more skepticism about science when it comes to making policy decisions?
Well, I think that that's true. I think that you're certainly seeing in legislatures across the country, many conservative politicians doubting what I think many scientists would consider sound science. But at the end of the day, this is, what we're talking about here is like a lot of issues where science shouldn't necessarily trump lots of things, but science should always trump politics. And I think that, when you're looking at this baiting ban, I think that you've got some, Senate Republicans in this case who want, who are listening to folks in the industry, listening to the guys who own the elevators, that it's a moneymaker for them to grow the sugar beets and the corn and the carrots to that they can sell at a higher profit for deer baiting. So
we should note it was not just Republicans, though. Democrats voted for it.
No, well, again, this is a move led by Senator Shirky, and I think that, you've got even people in his own district that, benefit from the baiting industry. It's an industry. It's not just a hobby for some people. So, I do think that there is an economic part, and I won't deny that. There's an economic part to this that's important for agriculture across the state. But at the end of the day, we can't cut our nose off to spite our face. And the science and every scientific expert tells us here that to combat chronic wasting disease, which could decimate Michigan's herd, we've got to ban baiting. And that's where I think the governor is, and that's where we all should be.
Ken, the question was, is there greater skepticism among policymakers about scientific reports and science in general?
Oh, I think there is, mainly because sometimes relying on sound science would lead to a decision that is just politically not very palatable to some people. But I fear we've kind of entered an era where it's no longer about science. It's now about Republican science and Democratic science.
Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's also a former Republican Majority Leader of the Michigan Senate. T.J. Buchholz is President of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. They join us on most Fridays to help us better understand what the heck is behind the news headlines. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lester.
Thank you, Lester.
Join us on Monday when we continue our series looking at pollution in Michigan. Decades before we learned about widespread PFAS contamination, Michiganders were faced with another pollution disaster.
There was this immediate sort of chaos right after that happened, where people didn't know what was happening with their cattle or what was really happening with their bodies.
Lessons missed from Michigan's 1973 PBB disaster. That's Monday on Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, Mercedes Mejia, Adam Reyes, and Catherine Newhan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.